Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay. Today is November 11th, which is Armistice Day. So I'm going to talk about Armistice Day, or reflect on what that means as we're in the midst of a war as a nation. There's a chair over here if you'd like to sit in the chair, or you can sit in the cushion, your choice. Jack, welcome. Today is Armistice Day, November 11th, which is a national holiday. The term comes from arma, or armaments, weapons, in Latin, and stitium, which comes from sistere, which means to stand in Latin. And that stis, that solstice, is the same word as in solstice, armistice and solstice, and the solstice being when the earth gets to a point where it, if you will, stands and then turns in terms of a point in time at which the angle of the earth starts going backwards. So armistice basically means to stop weapons, to truce, to stand still. A cessation of hostilities, or cessation or end of hostilities. It was originally a Remembrance Day on November 11th, 1918, when there was a truce at the end of World War I. The treaty did not get signed for another 8 months, but eventually Armistice Day became a national holiday. In other parts of the world, it's called Remembrance Day. And in this country, at some point, I think 1954, but I might be wrong, it became Veterans Day, which basically was then a change in emphasis from remembering the dead and the cessation of hostilities to honoring veterans alive and dead. So it seemed like a good day to talk or to do some reflection, because we are at war. We are at war. There's a quote from the introduction to The Way of the Bodhisattva. The Way of the Bodhisattva is a kind of a classic Indian Buddhist text. And this is from the introduction, but we'll put in perspective, hopefully, my talk this morning. Anger, defined as the flooding of the mind with violent and aggressive feelings leading naturally to hostility and conflict, is outlawed in Buddhism, as in no other religious tradition. Even so-called righteous anger, so often excused as having injustice and abuse as its object, is utterly condemned if this involves the overpowering of the mind in a wave of uncontrollable and destructive passion. The point being is that as a tradition, Buddhism really focuses on anger and the cessation of anger. I don't know that Buddhism outlaws anything. And I do know that Buddhism has supported war as a religion in the past. But all that said, the point being that Buddhism does deal with anger, and the cessation of anger as a fundamental object of its practice and study. You look at that. I was driving on the way over, and I passed the Unitarian Church, and I saw three bumpers, the same bumper sticker, a little bit different. I mean, but basically, it's the bumper sticker that says, "If you aren't outraged, you aren't paying attention." I mean, have you seen that bumper sticker? And you know that makes some inherent sense in the world we live in today. If you read Kath and Kirsten, for instance, you might get outraged. But it when you put it in a Buddhist context, it makes you wonder a little bit. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how hostilities and hatred arise, and how they cease, or how they can cease. Pema Chodron, in a book called Peace at a Time of War, I think, makes the statement that the origin of war and peace is at the level of the human heart. And she argues, or makes the case, that unless there is peace at the level of the human heart, peace movements will not be successful. So how does anger arise, and how does peace arise in the human heart? We all get anxious and uneasy, feel discomfortable throughout the day for various reasons. An example might be, on a nice summer day, you hear the buzz of a mosquito. Or you're driving on the highway from St. Paul to Minneapolis, and somebody cuts you off on the highway, or cuts right in front of you. Or is tailgating you. And often, if we pay attention to that, there's a tightening. There's something visceral that happens when that mosquito buzzes, and it causes us discomfort. It at some level it stimulates fear, and oftentimes we take off on that, and it's not just the buzz. All of a sudden, we're thinking, oh my God, I didn't put the off on. Or it's going to be a really bad day for mosquitoes. Or I got to get that thing before it bites me. And we just amp up, oftentimes emotionally and in our thoughts, without even knowing it. Things begin to spin, out of habit. Same thing with car cutting you off. And those are small things. They could be bigger things. They could be that you feel like you've been betrayed by your partner. Or you might have a developer who's about to put in an eight-story apartment building on the other side of the alley behind your house. It might be that you've got somebody that you work with that you really don't like, and you have to go in day in and day out, and every time you go into the office, there's something visceral that happens. It's the same phenomenon as that mosquito. It can also be something that's really quite impersonal, like an airplane hits the World Trade Towers. Same phenomenon. That's 1,500 miles away. It really is kind of an abstract thing. And yet it's oftentimes the same response. The same tightening of fear. And as human beings, there's no getting away from that. There will always be mosquitoes. There will always be those drivers that cut you off. There will always be difficulties in interpersonal relationships. But what we do with it really makes quite a bit of difference. How we respond to it is the difference between cessation of anger and hostilities and the cultivation of peace and repose and serenity. And it's really easy. It is really easy. And impossible at the same time. But the first step is simply noticing. The first step is simply noticing. And it often is noticing a physical response. Being sensitive enough to notice that, oh yeah, there's a little tightening going on there in my solar plexus or in my heart. Softness has become a little more rigid. And simply by noticing before you take off, before that plane taxis down the runway and takes off, with all of the emotions and responses that are usually unconscious. By simply noticing, a space is created that offers a choice between, oh my God, I got to go back, I got to get the off, it's going to be a horrible day, all the mosquitoes are out, between that and, ah, that's what it's like to be anxious about a mosquito. Simply notice rather than being and going off in that spin out, to be able to simply notice that it's happening and letting go. It's a practice that we do on the cushion when we meditate, and it's a practice that can be done in our day-to-day lives, and it is the difference. It is the difference, or it is a path to the cessation of anger. So we're dealing with two of the four noble truths. Suffering exists, which is the first noble truth in Buddhism, that there are mosquitoes, that there are, that we do have to live in this world where we have to deal with people who push our buttons or do things that upset us. That there's no getting away from that as a human being, and there is a path to serenity and peace and joyful repose, and the a technique, if you will, is simply to be slow enough to notice when your buttons are being pushed, and to take a breath, and to create the space. Now that doesn't mean, for sure, that doesn't mean because you created the space that everything is okay. I mean, it doesn't. You still have, I mean, mosquitoes may really be bad that day. I mean, they may be out in force, and you might have to change your plans because of it. But you can change them with a different attitude or a different spirit. You can change your plans with a different spirit. Katagiri Roshi, who was the founder of this temple, a book has recently come out with some of his talks. And this is another take at the issue of anger and hostilities and how they arise. He talks about, he quotes Dogen Zenji, who is the founder of the Soto school which is this center's tradition. In an essay called Giving and Receiving the Teaching of the Precepts, Dogen says, the threefold wheel is pure and clean, nothing to be desired. They go along together with the Buddhas. Let me read that one more time. The threefold wheel is pure and clean, nothing to be desired. They go along together with the Buddhas. The threefold wheel is... He describes it in here as possibly being two interpretations to that. The threefold wheel being kind of cosmic structure, mandala, the nature of the universe. And the threefold element of it is could be interpreted two ways. One is as body, speech, and mind. Body, mind, and speech. Kind of our physical and mental existence. And another interpretation of the threefold wheel is anger, greed, and delusion. And anger, greed, and delusion in Buddhism are three hindrances or poisons, three causes of suffering, if you will. And so Dogen is saying the threefold wheel, that is our physical manifest, I mean who we are in this world, or anger, greed, and delusion, the threefold wheel is clean and pure, nothing to be desired. They go along together with the Buddhas. So in the paradoxical way of Zen, Dogen is saying that anger, greed, and delusion are the Buddha. That anger is not something that is separate from you, is separate from reality, is separate from the Buddha. Anger is the Buddha. Greed is the Buddha. A little later he's talking about, well, how is that? He says, how can you turn the poison of anger into the wheel of anger? So how can you turn the poison or hindrance of anger into the cosmic structure? I mean, how can that be? How can you do that? And then he quotes Dogen again. Does anybody have a watch? No, Dogen didn't say that. But does anybody have a watch? Because I need
it.
Oh, there's a clock. All right, great. Thank you. No, that clock is big enough. He quotes Dogen again in another essay, saying, when the demon becomes Buddha, you should subdue him and let him become Buddha by dealing with the demon as Buddha. When the Buddha becomes Buddha, you should intend to become Buddha and let him become Buddha by dealing with the Buddha as the Buddha. When the person becomes Buddha, you should harmonize him and let him become Buddha by dealing with the person as Buddha. You should know that there is a passage to freedom the moment you deal with something as Buddha. And the fundamental principle, or the fundamental of Buddhism is suffering and the end of suffering. And the passage to freedom. So you should know that there is a passage to freedom the moment when you deal with something as Buddha. So, demon, Buddha, person, deal with them all as Buddha because they are all Buddha. The anger and hatred and greed and avarice is as much the Buddha as joy and serenity and repose. We get into this duality or this mindset that they are different, and we experience them differently. I mean, I'm not saying we don't experience them differently, but at a fundamental level, they aren't different. But the manifestation of the Buddha is that anger arising. Is that hatred arising? That is a manifestation of the Buddha. And our attitude towards it is what makes the difference. It makes a difference in how you respond to a mosquito. It makes a difference in how you respond to a driver who's cut you off. It makes a difference between or in how you respond to your wife or husband or partner. And it is very easy. At some level, it's easy in that it's a matter of simply noticing and letting go. Noticing and letting go. And it's very hard. And it's virtually impossible. And so how does this all relate to Armistice Day, which is the topic of this talk? Human or the difference between anger and peace is not something that happens globally. It really does have to happen in individual lives. However, we are in the midst of a war, and some would argue, myself being one of them, that it's a war that had no purpose, no justification whatsoever. We are in a war in which we as a nation, our elected officials paid by our taxes, establish policies to torture. Now, notice what's happening. If anybody's feeling any tightening about that, or just notice that. Create the space. We're in a fix. We are in a fix, and we are to some extent responsible, I think, for the situation we find ourselves in. So what do we do with that? First of all, Buddhism, this focus on turning the light within does not preclude thinking. It doesn't preclude making judgments. It doesn't preclude speaking up. It doesn't preclude taking a stand. It's just be aware when you do that what's happening and what the motivation is. I've been to plenty of demonstrations, peace demonstrations, where the anger was palpable, where the potential for violence, quite frankly, was very, very palpable. That's a really odd juxtaposition, a peace march or a peace rally that's fueled on hatred and anger. That's it. Buddhism does not preclude thinking and making a stand and giving voice to injustice or to wrongs. In fact, Buddhism acknowledges that besides the suffering that we all experience, there are causes and conditions, structural causes and conditions of suffering. And so, how do we encourage a cessation of hostilities at that level? I was reading preparation for this talk was reading, I went to the website of the American Friends Service Committee, Quaker. It's kind of the Quaker arm for social action and justice. And they had a few figures, which just kind of blew my mind, about the expenses of a day of war in Iraq, which they estimated to be $720 million a day. And what could be done with that $720 million a day? Well, in one day of war, if that money were used to provide scholarships, four-year scholarships to college, in one day, about 34,900 scholarships could be provided. One day's expense of the war could pay the annual salaries of 12,478 teachers. Could provide 95,364 Head Start places. It could build 6,482 new homes. In one day's expense on the war, any of those things could be done. But the same day, I read an article in the New York Times about the school system in Los Angeles. And in one district, one in five students can do math at the grade level. At one high school, only 7 out of 100 kids can do math at the grade level. 1,000 of California's schools are branded as chronic failures under the federal government's No Child Left Behind. And in despair, the principal of one of the school districts said, "What are we supposed to do? Shut down every school?" And yet we're spending $740 million. You and I, this is our money, folks. $740 million a day on the war. I mean, Buddhism does not require you to forget about that. Or bringing it a little closer to home, there are 9,000 to 9,300 people homeless in the state today. About a third of them are kids, and about 40% of them are African American or black. And African Americans or blacks represent about 3% of the state's population. In one day, we could build 6,482 homes with what we're spending on the war. Or we could hire 12,500 teachers. So what do we do as good practicing Buddhists about all that? I would argue that we should not get outraged the way the bumper sticker tells us to get outraged, that's not the solution. And when you feel that anger and hatred, pay attention to it. Create the space to let go of that anger and hatred, because if you don't, my guess is you'll become depressed and inactive and unable to move. That would be my guess, because it is so overwhelming. That is kind of the place we go, because we have to, because it is quite overwhelming. So I would encourage you to do something, and I'm going to offer you one suggestion. I'm going to tell you what to do. But I do want to say this pretty clearly, because, I simply want to say that Buddhism, which is a reflective tradition that looks inward, that deals with anger and hatred, the only place, quite frankly, you can deal with anger and hatred, which is in your own heart. You can't do it anywhere else. Although that is the focus of Buddhism, it does not preclude being aware of the hostilities and anger and hatred in the world, and and our role in it. And I do want to again emphasize that it's our money, it's our elected officials that are running the war on this Armistice Day. But I don't have any solutions. But I think it's important to reflect. I think it's important not to let Armistice Day simply go by and not pay attention and not reflect. And I will offer an option or something to encourage that reflection. I'm going to I should have thought this through better before I got up here to speak. I am going to fast the first Friday of every month during the daylight hours as a practice to reflect on the war and to just bring the war into my awareness. And I am going to offer anyone who would like to join me in that, just give me your email address, and I will just have a little virtual sangha that is interested in simply taking one day a month and fasting as a way to encourage ourselves to be aware of war and violence in the world. And hold that. And just hold it. My assumption is that by dedicating a little time in our lives to do that, that something will change. And I'm not sure what it will be, and it probably wouldn't be the same thing for everybody. But so I offer that out. Once, the first Friday of every month, a fast during the daylight hours to simply be aware of the war in a different way, perhaps, than we're aware of it when we read the relentless pages, relentless news articles about the deaths that are. It's a different way of being aware and bringing it into our attention. One last thing before I open it up. This practice of being aware of when anger and hatred arises in our life, it really is fundamental to the practice of Buddhism. And it really is important to maintain a meditation practice, a daily meditation practice that without that it becomes a. Well, I want to encourage people to use to have a meditation practice, specifically. To be aware of those, to turn the light inward and be aware of when anger and hatred and greed are arising. Didn't talk about greed, but that is another great motivator for war. So, what I would like to do before we open it up to questions is, because it is Armistice Day, because it is a day to remember and reflect on laying down of arms and hostilities. I'd like to take just a couple of minutes and sit, and then we'll open it up to discussion.
you ask the question again?
No, I'm just joking. That's what my long pause was when I put it out, because I hadn't thought that one through.
Because the days are short now.
Yeah. That went through my mind.
Mine too.
You know, a little slow, Jack, but you got it there.
Always carry it over into the summer.
I would say, there's something that would argue for a firm commitment till the end of the war. I'd like to be a little lighter than that. maybe just commit through the end of the year. Maybe just commit to the end of... What did I say I was going to commit to, by the way?
You said the first Friday.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought
so leave, that would only be one time.
Some people could think I'm a weasel. Yeah.
November. Oh, the first.
Yeah. Till the we're coming up on the winter solstice, so through the summer solstice would be the commitment, and then kind of reassess, reevaluate, and see what. Thanks. Yeah, that was. Oh, thank you for making that clarification. Any other? Yes.
I appreciate your commitment to make that space in your life. And I'm sort of in the process of trying to figure out how to make a similar commitment. Also, with traditional means, there's a just speech or oration seems to have been an art form that was instrumental in raising awareness and inspiring people for social change or movement. And the last time I heard an inspiring speech was many moons ago. I think there's a new need for public discourse. And what I've found personally is that feeling, that tightness, can become very overwhelming. But through the writing, and more so the sharing of poetry, is just fantastic catharsis. And not only does it release that tightness, but it opens me up in a very, very refreshing sort of way. And so the thing that I've decided to do, that I haven't done yet, is to bring it back to the days of old with the soapbox speeches. Because I feel like the only thing I can really do is just kind of get out there and say, well, this is the way I feel about stuff. And life is so compartmentalized now that your channels of communication, sometimes it's expected that you have credentials before you state your opinion. Mm-hmm. But I'm just actually going to go into public spaces. And I don't have a soapbox, but I don't think they really make those anymore. But you can get a hold of a milk crate in one of those big white buckets from Home Depot. And I'm really just going to stand on that. I'm going to go down to Nicollet Mall, University of Minnesota, just places that I happen to be in, and just really just stand up and say, I'm really sick of this. That's what I'm going to do. If your commitment is to fast or to say something or to talk to your friends or to write your congressman, whatever it is, then if it's about the war, if it's about, you know, there's a million things that are pressing on us right now. Just do something.
Thanks. And I part of two things, two responses to that. One is, as you do it, I encourage you again to kind of come back to awareness and where it's coming from and what's happening to your heart and your stomach and your body and your mind as you're on that soapbox. And the second one is this idea of a group of people within this sangha committing to a day of fasting or a regular time of fasting to create the space. I guess part of my hope would be that that is a space also that other things will come out of. It may be soapboxes. It may be other things. I actually last night printed off Lincoln's second inaugural address. We're talking about oration, which was almost at the end of the war, but it was his reflections on. I mean, that was a pretty violent hostage. I mean, there was a lot going on there. And what I remembered and why I printed it off and why I almost used it this morning was because his attitude was one of he never invoked God on his side during that, or the North side during that speech, or during that address. He invoked God a lot in that address, more than I remembered. But it was really kind of a karmic invocation of God, if you will. It's like, we got ourselves into this, folks, and it's a horrible situation, and let's hope what we're doing is the right thing. But it was, in terms of oration, and I thought, we do not hear that kind of reflection on war at this time in this country. Anything else? Jack?
I don't know why it came to me. The whole idea about fasting, I just thought about a good friend of mine from New Orleans who has started this practice, actually, I think for the last few years now that I've been doing this. If you're going to fast, the food that you would have eaten that day or the meal you would have prepared for yourself, either go out and purchase a meal or make a meal or something like that, go out and seek out a homeless person and say, would you like some food? Mm-hmm. Give it to them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a little bit of money.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to do when you're fasting.
Well, it makes it all the more sweet.
Then it could be the money that you would have spent on food to give to someone else to spend on food.
That's what made me think of it. Just
make the effort to fix a meal or buy a meal or something, and go and seek out a homeless person and just give it to them.
Yeah.
Just ask them,
would you like some food?
Yeah.
My first reaction when you brought up the violence and is this image that I remember from the Vietnam War, and it is that the monk setting himself on fire, and how much that just resonates with me still, because of their peace and their and it so much involves our country and on top of theirs, and then to have that protest in their streets, and we don't have that at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's there for me, and it's resonating of what can I do to not have that happen, but also, like everybody else has said, there's so much pressing down on us. Where do you begin?
Mm-hmm.
And I like some of what Katagiri said. You know, one of the first chapters, he talks about walking through the desolation of war-torn Japan and praying for the Buddha to change it all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and realizing as he grew up that it had to happen with him. You know, and I think that's the important part that we can take back. Is that it just happened, you know, like become a sangha. Let it happen with us and wherever we go and wherever, you know, we do have soapboxes. We have the blogosphere. And you don't have to have credentials to be up on that. So.
Thanks. Anything else? Oh, yes.
not understand how you can call emotion Buddha, and where do you draw the line? What is not Buddha? And is it all emotions of Buddha, or what do you mean by calling it Buddha?
Well, I think. This may not help your confusion, but I think the point that Dogen was making in that situation, in that quote, was that I'm going to throw in another concept, but a fundamental Buddhist concept is that everything is empty. Everything is has no discrete entity, or no discrete. There's no discrete self. That everything is devoid of something you can pin down and say, this is you, this is me, this is the floor. And the flip side of that is everything is totally connected, that the floor doesn't exist without everything else in the universe, and you don't exist without everything in the universe, that everything is totally linked in a dynamic moment, which is what is here now. And so in that sense of everything being, I mean, there's no other moment than this moment, and everything is really exists only because everything else exists, that nothing is in and of itself, stands on its own, because of that interconnectedness and that lack of ability to chop up and make kind of discrete things, the whole of it is Buddha. The whole of it is existence and reality, and to that extent, quote unquote negative stuff and positive stuff, emotions, thoughts, everything is in that moment, constitutes reality, constitutes Buddha, constitutes oneness. So I think that's what Dogen was saying. Does that help or make things worse? Okay. All right. Well, I think we probably need to go on to announcements.